We come now to Judges chapter 4. We've seen three judges so far, and two cycles, those which are so common in the book of Judges, where Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord, which is the first thing that happens in chapter 4 again. And then oppression comes as a chastisement from the Lord. And then the story continues. Eventually the people cry out to God. He sends a judge. Things go better. And then they go back to their bad ways again. We've seen that cycle complete twice in the time of Othniel and also Ehud. In Othniel's case, it was the king of Mesopotamia that he defeated, and after 8 years of oppression, and after he delivered Israel, there was rest for 40 years. In the second case, it was the Moabite king Eglon, confederate with Ammon and the Amalekites, ancient enemies of Israel, who came, and they were defeated under the leadership of Ehud after an 18-year oppression, and we read that there was peace in the land for 80 years after this victory. Then we read about Shamgar, and he's not really associated with the cycle at all. It's possible that his activities were singular. Rather, he didn't judge. We're not told that he judged Israel. We're just told that he delivered Israel. He may have judged Israel also, but not enough detail is given for us to know. It's possible even that his exploits overlap in time, those from the period of Ehud. After all, there were 80 years there of peace. It's possible that there was a brief interruption of that peace, not even worthy of mentioning because it was a blip. And Shamgar was the man of the hour who conquered a Philistine incursion of maybe 600 men, but he defeated them all and put an end to that. So in chapter 4, when Ehud was dead, it doesn't say when Shamgar was dead, so it would seem that Shamgar's activities probably belong within the period of Ehud's judgeship. So when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Now, Jabin, the king of Canaan, about 100 years earlier, had marshaled a confederacy of all the northern nations against Joshua in the 11th chapter of Joshua, and so Jabin can't be the same man. It is the same city, Hazor, but apparently the Canaanite kings of this region were all called Jabin. It's not known to be so, but it's probable, unless this is like Jabin the Third or something like that. 100 years earlier, approximately, there had been a Jabin, over 100 years earlier, who had been defeated by Joshua. And here's another Jabin in the same area, a king also of the region. Some areas, some lands had the same name for all their kings. Obviously, Egypt with their pharaohs is a good example. All the kings of Egypt were called Pharaoh. They had personal names as well, but they were all called Pharaoh. And also, it seems like Abimelech may have been a title, a royal title name for the kings of Gerar. It's possible, because we read of more than one Abimelech in different generations in that city. So some cities may have just had an office title for the person who held the high office, and Jabin may have been that title for Hazor, because, like I say, this would not be the same man who was mentioned as this, by the same name in the same city in Joshua 11. The commander of this man's army was Sisera, who dwelt at Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. For 20 years he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. It's interesting that it would be that number, 900 chariots of iron, because as I said earlier, Thutmose III The Pharaoh, in his inscriptions, boasted of having captured 900 chariots of iron from the Canaanites in his day. But that was, Thutmose III was probably a few centuries before this. But it's the same region, the same weaponry, and even the same number, 900. So maybe for centuries this particular region had maintained a chariot force of 900. And when they were captured by Thutmose, they replaced them all, chariot for chariot, and maintained essentially the same size force. But that is what made him so formidable. Chariots of iron, that's what intimidated the children of Israel. Both the Ephraimites, when they are offered to have some territory, Joshua gave them territory, but they said, we can't take it because there's chariots of iron. He said, no, you can. And also the Judahites, the people of Judah, in chapter 1 and verse 19, it says that they were unable to take their territory because the Canaanites there had chariots of iron. As I say, the most invincible weaponry of that period. And Jabin and his general Sisera had 900 of them. That made him seem invincible, especially when Israel was fairly unarmed. They were mostly unarmed people. And we see that, as I mentioned before, in chapter 5 and verse 8. Chapter 5, verse 8 in the Song of Deborah, it's remembering the time, verse 6, the days of Shamgar and the days of Jael. Well, Jael was contemporary with Deborah and with this period we're talking about right now. And it says, they chose new gods. Then there was war in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. In other words, Israel was pretty much a disarmed people. They didn't have a military force. And their enemy had 900 chariots of iron. Seems pretty much like the deck is stacked against any possible rebellion arising against Sisera and his chariot force. And so for 20 years he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Not just had them under tribute, but oppressed them harshly. Treated them badly. Sometimes they were just under tribute to a king who was satisfied just to take their money. But this man wanted to actually oppress them and hurt them. He's probably, you know, angry at Israel for having conquered his ancestors and taken that territory from his ancestral people. So there was real hostility there, not just a desire to control or a desire to get tribute from them. He really liked to persecute them. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidos, was judging Israel at that time. It's an interesting statement because this is the first time we read, I think, no, maybe not. Othniel might have been doing it too. He might have been judging before his victories too. But usually the judges judge after they bring victory. But Deborah already appears to be recognized as a judge at this time. And it was probably the fact that she was recognized as having the prophetic gift that made people trust her. Very uncommon, of course, for a woman to be in leadership in Israel. As far as we know, she's the only woman that ever served as a judge in a period of over 300 years. And they never had a ruling queen in Israel, except during a time when a usurper, the queen's grandmother, killed her grandchildren, the heirs to the throne, and took over for a while. But then she got herself killed too. She was definitely not legitimate. But very seldom did Israel have female rulers. The northern kingdom had sort of a de facto female ruler in Jezebel, although really she was just the wife of the king, but Jezebel was the power behind the throne. She wore the pants in that family. It's very obvious because Ahab was sort of a weak and sniveling character, and Jezebel was a strong woman who definitely dominated. It was actually her daughter Athaliah that killed her own grandchildren and made herself the queen of Judah, but came to a bad end herself. But females in leadership in Israel were unusual, and certainly in the Middle East in general. Women typically were seen as, you know, supposed to be homemakers and, you know, domestic, and they didn't go to war and things like that, and they certainly didn't go out and do business. But when a woman had the prophetic gift, that changed everything. Because, in fact, this is the first mention in the Bible of the gift of prophecy. We have not read of the gift of prophecy even in the stories of Moses and Joshua, though they certainly were prophets. Moses spoke in the name of the Lord, and so did Joshua. So they were clearly prophets, but we don't read specifically of someone being a prophet with a title like that, or prophetess in this case, until we come to Deborah. And so since Israel was a theocracy, and they're governed by God, when somebody could actually speak prophetically from God, that put them in the position to provide leadership for the nation that was supposed to be obeying God. And so she was put in the position of a judge. How her gift was originally recognized and how she came to be trusted in this position, we're not told. She is said to be the wife of Lapidos, but since the word Lapidos in Hebrew means a torch, some people think it's a figurative expression, not a reference to her husband, but that she was a torch-like woman, or that she, there's some people feel that this is more of a reference to her fiery disposition or her something about her character rather than, you know, her married status. Well, it's hard to say. She could have had a husband whose name meant torch. There, almost all the names meant something. And so we read of her judging Israel this time. Now, many times people, when we consider the desirability or legitimacy of females being, say, pastors of churches or elders of churches in our time, it's a controversial subject, and there's many who definitely defend it as a good thing. Others say it's not a good thing. Now, those who say it's not a good thing would generally go by what Paul said about elders in 1 Timothy, beginning at around chapter 2, verse 12, I think, and moving on through the chapter division into chapter 3, Paul talks about qualifications for being recognized as what he calls an overseer of the church in that passage, which is the same thing as an elder. And initially he says, I don't permit a woman in that role. But then he goes on and talks about the men who have to qualify, and you can see he wouldn't permit most men in that role either. There's not probably one man in 100 that would, in the modern church, that would qualify by Paul's qualifications for eldership. So it's not just women, but men are mostly disqualified, and women, by Paul's standards, seem to be entirely disqualified. One of the reasons being that it says the elder must be the husband of one wife and able to prove his leadership qualifications by his leadership of his home. And since the man is the head of his home, you know, he's uniquely in the position to prove his management ability in his home in a way that a wife might not be able to, because the wife, though she has authority over children, she doesn't really make all the decisions for the home in the way the husband does. So she wouldn't really be able to prove herself in that sphere in the same way that a man would. But there's also Paul's concern about preserving God's order of things, because when Paul says, I don't let a woman teach or have authority over a man, he says, because... And many people think Paul should say, because it's socially unacceptable that that'll change in the 20th and 21st century. But he doesn't say that. He says, because God made man first and then made woman to be the helper of man. And woman also took the lead, he says, in the fall. He didn't use the word fall, but in transgression. So, in other words, because of the way God set things up in the Garden of Eden and the way things transpired there, Paul says that God's order for things seems to be that man should take the lead. Now, that becomes the basis for Paul saying that women should not be the official leaders in the church. And that can be pressed more legalistically than it should be, because there are times like that of Deborah's time, when God did use a woman in leadership, that we don't read of a man who had the gift of prophecy. But, on the other hand, many of the women that want to be pastors don't have the gift of prophecy either, you know. If God gives the gift of prophecy, there definitely is something special about that situation. They can speak for God as someone cannot who doesn't have the gift. And many times people who argue in favor of women being pastors want to make no distinction at all between men and women in the choice of Christian leadership, and they often will appeal to Deborah. Deborah is obviously the obvious case to give in their favor, because God did allow a woman to play the role of leadership in the nation that usually was that of a man. But that's just the point. It usually was that of a man. It is true that God made an exception, but it was truly an exception. We've got 13 judges. One of them's a woman. Jesus chose 12 apostles, none were women. Although he had women that he highly regarded, probably there were women that he was, you know, closer with than he was to some of his other apostles. It's clear that Mary Magdalene and Mary and Martha were all very close friends of Jesus. And it's possible that they were as close to him as any of the apostles were. But when it came to choosing the apostles, he didn't choose any women. He was not apparently gender blind, because there were at least, I'm sure, as many women as men following him, if the demographics of the church at any other time in history would be an indication. Certainly the church attracts more women than men, and there's more women on the mission field than there are men at any given time. Women are much more available and responsive to Christ than men are, usually, and therefore it was probably not different in his day. There were probably at least as many women as men following him. And he had respect for them. He regarded them highly. But when it came to choosing leadership, he didn't choose any women for any of the 12 positions he had. And the book of Judges has 13 people that serve as judges. One of them is a woman. What does that tell us? It tells us that it's not very common for God to put a woman in that position. It also tells us that God's not real legalistic about that. He'll use a woman if he wants to. That's up to him. It shows that God is willing to break the mold and act outside the box on occasion, but it would be a mistake to say that there's a gender blindness in all this. If it was gender blindness, we would expect there to be at least, well, maybe at least half of the judges to be women, or at least more than one out of 13. So it would seem that it's truly a real exception. And in this particular case, we will find that Deborah was willing to take the lead, where a man whom God called was not so willing to take the lead. And we find that may be a factor in why she was the judge. Verse 5 says, she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah. Apparently the palm tree came to be named after her because of that being her bench, where she would judge legal matters. Between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Then she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not Yahweh, God of Israel, commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun. And against you I will deploy Sisera." God says to him, "I'm going to deploy Sisera against you." Well, that doesn't sound encouraging. God's deploying both sides to go into battle. "The commander of Jabin's army with his chariots and his multitude." She doesn't make it sound very easy. She didn't just say, "Go and fight the Lord's battle." She says, "God's going to bring Sisera with all his chariots and all his multitude against you too." Makes it sound like a challenge, a little intimidating in fact. "At the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand." And Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." I got a feeling he's saying, "You know, I know you speak for God sometimes, but I don't know that you always do. How sure are you of this, Deborah? If you'll go along and put your neck on the block with me, I'll take your word for it. I'll bet this is God. I'll consider that this is what God really is saying, and that you're not just trying to get rid of me, sending me off to a hopeless cause." And I don't know that all that is implied, but the point is, he doesn't want to go without her. Now, whether that's saying that she needs to put her money where her mouth is too, and not just send off him on a dangerous mission, if she wants to go on the mission too, then he'll take her seriously. Or whether he's saying, "You know, you are the person who speaks for God around here. I don't want to go out to battle without someone who speaks for God to instruct me and to, you know, guide me in this matter. You're God's person. I'd like you along, since this is going to have to be a battle that I stay in touch with God about, because it's going to be supernatural." It's hard to say whether he is honoring her or challenging her. It doesn't really say. But he's not going to go without her. So she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking, for Yahweh will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. Now, we don't know if she actually fought in the battle. She went to the place where they were going to be deployed from, but she didn't necessarily go out and fight. I don't know if there's any argument for female combatants in war in this story. Now, she says that the credit for the victory is going to go to a woman. And in this conversation, no doubt, the assumption was that means Deborah. The credit's going to go to Deborah. In other words, she's saying, I won't go unless you go. You'd expect to say, okay, then I'll get the credit, and you won't. And when she says, the credit's going to go to not you, but to a woman, it would naturally be assumed she means herself. But of course, as it turned out, it was a different woman who delivered Israel. In this case, there were two women who provided deliverance, and a man was sort of, you know, following far behind in the matter. The woman who really delivered them was not even an Israelite woman, but a Kenite woman. And she, of course, killed Sisera in her tent. But Deborah was a prophetess, and she knew that it would be a woman. She may have even thought it would be herself or not. I don't know what she thought, but she knew, got a word from the Lord, okay, I'm going to go with you, but there's going to be a woman who ends up with the credit for this victory. Because of Barak's reluctance, this may explain why God raised up women instead. Sometimes God may raise up a woman to do what should be a man's job, just to shame the men who won't do it. Men often neglect their duties in many fields. Certainly is true in the church. I sometimes wonder if the reason Paul said, I don't let women serve as bishops, is because if he did, they'd all be women. Because men would just sit back and watch TV and let their wives go to church and lead the church. Because women are willing to serve. Like I say, the mission field has more women than men on it. And the mission field is by definition a voluntary institution. You know, I mean, people voluntarily go on the mission field. No one makes them. And it's clear that women are more eager to do that. It used to be that all churches had Sunday services and midweek prayer meetings. The prayer meetings were mainly attended by women. The Sunday service might have about an equal number of men because the women drag their husbands along with them, or there might be men who actually are, you know, leaders spiritually in their homes, but still, women tend to be more willing than men in general to step up and take leadership roles. This is true in the home in some cases, although a lot of times women who end up taking leadership in their home actually complain because their husbands won't. Men can be very remiss. Maybe because men are, in a sense, the leaders, they feel like they can just kind of order their family members, their wives and children to do all the work, you know, like a man would to his servants or something like that. So he just sits back and takes his ease and makes his wife do all the hard, you know, work, make all the hard decisions. That is not how it's supposed to be, but that could be a result of the fall. We know that as a result of the fall, which was really a case of a woman taking the lead in the family, and the husband kind of sheepishly going along with her, right? I mean, she's the one who made the decision to eat first, and then she gave it to her husband, and he, you know, without any backbone at all, just apparently went along with her on it. Doesn't sound like he took any stand. And yet, he's supposed to be the leader. She was supposed to be his helper. He was supposed to be the head, and he just let her lead. And that's what people do. And I personally think that if there was never any restriction on women being elders, it would be a short time, and you'd see all the elder positions be held by women. And men would just say, that's fine with me. Let my wife do the work. See, a lot of people think, and maybe women are told this too, that the men, they want to oppress women, they want to keep them down. Occasionally you'll find a man like that, an insecure man, a man who just, you know, he'd oppress anybody he could, and a woman's an easy person to oppress because she's in the home and she's weaker than he is, so he can oppress her. He's the same kind of man who'd oppress anybody if he could. He probably oppresses his children too. It's not a suppression of women per se. It's just that there's jerks who just like to take advantage of other people. They are probably not in the majority. It seems to me that most Christian men, at least, would just let their wives rule. And that's why men have to be, you know, forced to do the work that they're supposed to do. They have to be commanded to take the lead. The women have to be forbidden from being in the post so that men have to take the post because they wouldn't otherwise. I really believe that's true from what I observe of Christian men and women in the church. Women are eager to serve. Men, for the most part, are reluctant and just glad to hand it off to somebody else. This stereotype of the dominating man who just wants to, you know, keep his wife down and keep her subservient and so forth. I know that men can do that because they're stronger and bigger than their wives, and they all sometimes do, but to me the stereotype to be more true to life seems to be the opposite. Not that the wife is domineering, but the husband just doesn't want to take charge. He'd just as soon live and let live and let his wife raise the kids, let his wife make the decisions, make the wife go to church and take the church responsibilities and so forth. That's pretty much, I think, how the modern man usually is. I remember years ago looking at a newspaper story about a conference in Chicago where there were two Christian organizations, one advocating gender blindness in ordination. You know, advocating that women and men should be equally ordained into ministry. And the other organization was an organization that, a Christian organization standing up for more of a traditional set of roles of the two genders, of the two sexes. And so this conference came together for them to try to meet and come to some agreement. I don't think they did, but the article I read had in bold type a quotation from some elder of a Mennonite church who happened to be a woman, so we could see which of the organizations she was representing. But in bold type it said, so-and-so, this elder, some lady, says that as long as, you know, the patriarchal paradigm is maintained in the church, there will never be an end of wife abuse and child abuse. In other words, she's blaming the idea that husbands are the head of the family on the fact that women and children sometimes get beat up in their homes. Well, of course, when women and children get beat up in their homes, it's usually by the man. That's true. But that's not because the Bible gives man headship. It's because the man's bigger and stronger and he's a jerk and he's not following the Bible. The Bible could say the woman's the head and the man would still beat her up. Yeah. It has nothing to do with the biblical teaching about man's role or woman's role or anything like that. It has to do with sin. And frankly, I think most husbands are not abusers. Even those, especially those who believe in the biblical norm. A man who takes his biblical role seriously is not going to abuse anybody because he takes his biblical role seriously. It's the people who are not taking their biblical role seriously that end up abusing people. And so my thesis is that men are more reticent, more reluctant to step forward and take leadership. Certainly we find Barak to be an example of that. He has to be told by Deborah to go, and then he still wants to demur and say, well, you know, if you go, I will. And so she says, okay, I'll go. But you're not going to win this battle. You'll lead the armies, but the battle will be won by someone else who will get the credit, a woman, in fact. And perhaps that is the way God arranged it, for the simple reason of putting Barak to shame and the men of Israel to shame for failing to rise up as Deborah did and as they should have done themselves. So, verse 10, Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. And he went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went with him. So I guess she did go to battle. I don't know that she wielded a weapon. I'm not sure what weapons they had, since there wasn't a shield or a spear among 40,000 in Israel. It's hard to know really what they were armed with, stones, sticks, you know, their shoes in their hands, what they beat them with. It's clear that this was like sheep going off to a slaughter, these Israelites going against 900 iron chariots. And what's more, they were fighting the battle down on the plain where the chariots operate best. They marshaled their troops at Mount Tabor, which is a conical mountain about, I think, 6 or 8 miles east of Nazareth. Kind of stands out of the plain like a cone. And, of course, a steep mountain is someplace where chariots wouldn't operate very well. So they could gather their troops together and mobilize there. But the battle was not fought on the mountain. This was not a case of a mountain fortress being defended against invaders. It was Israel attacking charioteers down on the plains. So here Israel is going to be on a battlefield that's the least advantageous for them in natural considerations. They're poorly armed, at best, if they're armed. Their enemy is armed with the best equipment available in the time. And so it looks like they're just going like sheep to the slaughter. But the only thing they have going for them is that God said they'd win. So they had God on their side, and that was, of course, why things went as well as they did. Now, it says in verse 11, "Now Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zaanim, which is beside Kedesh." And then it goes on and talks about the battle. It mentions Heber like out of nowhere and kind of parenthetical. And you read on a little bit and say, what's he got to do with this? Why are we told about this guy? This guy is Heber. He is not a Jew. He's a Kenite, which is what Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was. He's called Hobab here, but Jethro is known by three names in the Bible. He's called Hobab. Actually, four names. He's called Hobab, he's called Reguel, he's called Ruel, and he's called Jethro. But he's a Kenite, and these people, the Kenites, are descended from Moses' father-in-law, which means they're not Jewish. They were related to Israel only by marriage, and that wasn't even a very good marriage. Moses and his wife didn't have exactly a peaceable relationship. Spent most of their time separated, it seems to me. And when we do have them interacting, it's not a very friendly interaction. So, nonetheless, the contact that the Kenites came into with Israel through that marriage apparently lasted into at least a friendship between the clans. The Kenites lived among Israel during most of this time. They never fully assimilated, but they always seemed to be sympathetic toward Israel. And that is the case here. This man had moved from the rest of the Kenites, wherever they were mainly concentrated in the land, he moved off near the Kedesh, which was where Barak was from, and near where the battle was going to be fought. And so he had a tent there. Why is he mentioned? He's mentioned because Jael is his wife. And so, although this doesn't come up until later in the narrative, it is mentioned at this point that this man had pitched his tent in that region. And, of course, the reason that's important is because his wife is going to have an important guest over. And it says, "And they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, 'Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Lord gone out before you?' So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 following him." Actually, in the Hebrew, I believe 10,000 men following him. The term following him really in Hebrew is on foot. So they were on foot. They weren't in chariots or on horses. They were foot soldiers going out against 900 chariots. And it's interesting, the battle, the main fury of the battle is passed over with a single verse and not much detail. It's the sequel to it where the captain jumps out of his chariot and flees to the tent of Jael that really gets most of the attention. But the battle, which should have been a rout for Sisera against Israel, went the other way, but not because of Israel's great skills, but because it says the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. Now, why would he jump out of his chariot and run on foot? Certainly a chariot is faster than running on foot, generally speaking, unless you're Elijah the prophet. Elijah the prophet did outrun a chariot on one occasion, but that's rather supernatural. I don't think that Sisera had the same divine assistance on his side. So why did he abandon his chariot? It must be that in this rout, somehow the chariot became disabled. And this is how God gave the victory to Israel. Now, the assumption is there was some kind of a great storm. The river Kishon overflowed its banks. The ground may become really muddy, so the chariot wheels got bogged down. The word routed here in verse 15, the Lord routed Sisera, is the same expression used in a couple of other cases of importance. For example, in Exodus 14:25, when the Egyptians followed Israel into the parted Red Sea, it says that the Lord fought against, it's the same Hebrew word here, the Egyptians, and it says he took their chariot wheels off in the midst of the sea. So God's not worried about chariots. He can just remove the wheels. He doesn't even have to have them up on jacks. He can just pull them off while they're in motion, and they fall off. The chariots become disabled, and it's the same word. Now, it doesn't mean that this word in Hebrew means to remove chariot wheels, but it's the same term that God fought against Egypt, in that case, in Exodus 14, by taking the chariot wheels off. It was obviously a supernatural intervention against the enemies. There's another time this word is used in Joshua 10:10, and that's when God fought against, actually this same, a different force of people in the south, and when the hailstones came, God sent great hailstones. That's the day that God caused the sun to stand still for a while, and he killed more of the enemy with the hailstones than the Israelites killed with their swords. So this expression, God routed them, in previous occurrences has implied supernatural phenomena, pulling the chariot wheels off, sending hail. If you look over at chapter 5, where this battle is recounted poetically in the celebration song after the victory, in Judges 5, verses 20 through 22, describing what happened, it says, they fought from the heavens, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. So apparently there was a storm or a flooding of the river that swept away a lot of the chariots, probably muddied the ground, made the going rough for chariots. That ancient torrent, that great, the torrent of Kishon, O my soul, march on in strength. Then the horse's hooves pounded, the galloping of the steed. So there was something going on with the chariots, or the horses at least, and the river overflowing, and it's as if the stars from heaven were fighting against Sisera. It certainly is an indication that something was done that was recognized as acts of God rather than just the Israelites being militarily superior. Now, it is possible, of course, that once a guy fell out of a chariot that his sword or spear could be picked up by an Israelite on foot, and now he was an armed man. You know, we don't know what the Israelites had when they first advanced, but God fought against Sisera and killed them, disabled their chariots, I would imagine, which would explain why Sisera jumped out of his and ran. He didn't have any better means of mobilization than to flee on foot. And it says in verse 16, but Barak pursued the chariots of the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, who is the oppressor in this case, Sisera's master, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Now, remember, Heber had moved away from the rest of the Kenites and sort of set up a more isolated homestead out in the region near this battle. And apparently he was remote enough that Jabin didn't bother him and didn't consider him a threat. He wasn't an Israelite. He was alone. There was peace between them. That is, there was not aggressive activity against him by Jabin, and so there was considered to be, you know, a good relation here, at least a peaceable relation. Well, if so, it was only outward, because inwardly it's clear that this Kenite and his family were very much against Jabin and Sisera, and acted treacherously against them. It says in verse 18, and Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear. And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. Then he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. So she opened a jug of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, is there any man in here, you shall say no. Now, he was, of course, making himself quite vulnerable here, going to sleep, but he obviously felt like this was an ally and that she would cover for him. And when he asked for water, she went the second mile and gave him milk, which would be, you know, a more expensive, a more, you know, a more hospitable, a more generous thing to give him than just water. Perhaps to gain his trust that, you know, that she was, you know, on his side. Maybe even because milk has a tendency to encourage sleep in a way that water does not. Some rabbis think that she gave him an intoxicating drink. When the Song of Deborah is sung later on, it mentions that she gave him thickened milk. And in verse 25 of chapter 5, it says, he asked for water, she gave milk, she brought out cream in a lordly bowl. I think the milk or the cream, one of those in the Hebrew means thickened milk. Some commentators say she gave him yogurt. But it was not just a glass of milk. It was something a little more substantial that might perhaps make him feel full, make his body feel satisfied and more prone to go to sleep. So anyway, he did go to sleep. And he told her, you know, if anyone comes by, just say there's no one here. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. Pretty ugly and gruesome, but he died in his sleep. Might have been a moment of pain there, but if you die in your sleep, it's not as bad as dying awake. It was not very hospitable of her at all. I mean, you know, in the Middle East, hospitality is a highly esteemed thing. In fact, it's just a given in that culture that you will never harm anyone that you've invited into your home. That's perhaps why he was so confident that she wouldn't violate the code. That was the ethical code of all the society. In fact, it was understood that if you take someone into your home, you'll die before letting any harm come to them. And you'll make any sacrifice to save your guest. That's one reason why Lot, when the angels came to him, though he didn't know they were angels, he just thought they were ordinary men, when the men of the city wanted to abuse his guests, he offered his daughters instead, something that hardly seems acceptable by any of our standards. But it was just Middle Eastern hospitality. You'll sacrifice anything, your life or your family or whatever, if you've taken a guest in. It's just, I don't know how that code came to be, a given, but that's what they thought. So in a sense, Jael did something really treacherous, because she had taken a man in under her roof with the understanding that she would protect him with her life. Instead, she killed him. And then, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, I will show you the man whom you seek. And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with the peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So this apparently was an ongoing campaign. The story that we've been told is the main turning point, the initial victory. It was apparently followed up by ongoing resistance from Israel, and they grew stronger and stronger over time, apparently, against Jabin, until they finally driven him out and even destroyed him, perhaps killed the king. We don't know. So then we have chapter 5 devoted entirely to the song of victory which they sang. You know, after the Exodus, in chapter 14 of Exodus, we have, at the beginning of Exodus 15, a song of victory that was sung by Miriam and by Moses. It's called the Song of Moses. And it's just a song recounting the victory that God had given them. And this is the same kind of thing. This one's longer. Many scholars say that this song in chapter 5 is like the most exquisite example of Hebrew poetry imaginable. Like it's just the top rung of all Hebrew poetry in its quality. I have to say I'm not trained in poetry appreciation, even when it comes to English poetry. And when you take ancient Middle Eastern poetry, it's even more foreign to my taste, and I'm not sure what makes this so great. When I read the poem, I think, okay, they're happy, you know, but I'm not really sure why they express themselves the way they do. I don't know that if I were not told by literary experts that this is a fantastic poem, I'm not sure that I'd find it that impressive, but then that's me. What do I know? I'm not an expert in Middle Eastern literature or poetry. But I just let you know that this is a great poem for its time, according to those who know such things. And as all poetry does, it uses figurative language, which at times makes it hard to know whether we're seeing real details of the battle or whether they're using apocalyptic or poetic imagery. I mean, for example, the statement in verse 20 that the stars of heaven fought against Sisera. In what sense was that true? Does that mean that, you know, something came down from the sky to hit him? Was he taken out by a meteorite shower or what? I mean, what does the stars of heaven fighting mean? Or is it more the idea of the stars are personified a little bit as in astrology, where they almost like are seen as having some kind of influence over the affairs of Earth, and the defeat of Sisera was seen as, you know, he couldn't thank his lucky stars for that. You know, I mean, he didn't have lucky stars. The stars were fighting against him. I don't know, but there's poetic language throughout. It makes it difficult, as I say, to know how much is literal. But they do make, in the poem, there are references to historical events that are and characters, especially Shamgar, Jael, and Deborah are mentioned, and Sisera's mother, and Sisera. But Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang that day, saying, "When leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord." Now this first line, "when leaders lead," is actually an extremely difficult one to translate from the Hebrew. The commentators have different ideas of what it should mean. It's a difficult phrase. You'll notice if you have the New King James, and if you have marginal references, they read, an alternate way of reading it is, "when locks are loosed." And this would mean locks of hair. And so one translator, well, Alfred Edersheim actually, in his history, he preferred to render this first line, "for the loose flowing of the long hair, and for the dedication of the people, bless the Lord." Now, if there is a reference to locks of hair in that first line, or the loose flowing of long hair, then it may be, of course, a reference to the fact that women were involved in this war in a way that was unusual. Deborah was the true leader, and Jael was the true deliverer. In a sense, the long-haired ones, the women with the long flowing hair, they're the ones to celebrate in this situation. It may be a reference to the women, although obviously from the way it's rendered in the New King James, "when leaders lead in Israel," that's a very, very different meaning. But it's admittedly difficult to know what the exact meaning is supposed to be. Verse 3, "Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes." Now, Israel didn't have kings at this time, so it's an appeal to the non-Israelites, the pagans, the enemies. Pay attention, you guys. If you try to do to us what Jabin did, you might want to consider this. Think of what God did to Jabin. We'll tell you. "Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. Lord, when you went from Seir," that's the mountain where Edom lived, where the Edomites lived, "when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord, this Sinai, before the Lord God of Israel." Now this is apparently going back to Mount Sinai and the giving of the law. Some of the songs celebrating Mount Sinai speak of God coming out of Edom, or out of Mount Seir. Actually, in Deuteronomy, there's a song of Moses. When he talks about God coming to Sinai to give the law, he comes out of Mount Seir. I'm not sure why that particular location is mentioned, but it's also mentioned here. And therefore, it's apparently remembering when God first made his covenant with Israel. And this victory was due to that, of course. This victory much, much later is due to God keeping covenant with the people that he met with at Sinai originally. Verse 6, in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted, and the travelers walked along the byways. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. Then there was war in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord. So she's saying these rulers who actually volunteered to go out and fight in this battle against Sisera are to be commended because they were fighting against terrible odds in terms of the weaponry they had and didn't have and so forth. Verse 10, speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit in judges' attire, and who walk along the road, far from the noise of the archers among the watering places. There they shall recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers in Israel. Then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. Now this apparently is an appeal to people who would live peaceably and comfortably. They're riding their donkeys. They sit in nice clothing. They're not out on the battlefield in military garb. They're far from the noise of battle, of the archers. They're in the watering place. This is a picture of being at peace. And saying, you know, you who are at peace, it's not always that way. You have peace because of the war that was fought on this occasion. It's been accomplished for you by people who didn't have such safety and didn't have such peace in their conditions. Just like it's, people are fond to say today, you know, if you enjoy your freedom, you know, thank a soldier. You know, it's the same kind of idea. You who are comfortable here and prospering, realize that that was purchased for you at the cost of battle. Verse 12, awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. Then the survivors came down, the people against the nobles. The Lord came down for me against the mighty. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your people, from Macher, which is one of the branches of Manasseh, rulers came down, and from Zebulun, those who bear the recruited staff. Now, this must be the main tribes that became involved in the battle of deliverance. Though we don't read of Benjamin and Ephraim in the earlier story, we do read of Zebulun, Naphtali, and so forth, and Issachar. It says, the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As Issachar was, so Barak sent into the valley under his command. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Reuben did not participate in the battle, apparently. And she's saying, Reuben had to search their heart afterwards, saying, why didn't we get involved? Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? You just sit and listen to the music of the shepherds instead of going out fighting in the battle. The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. Gilead also stayed beyond the Jordan. They didn't come. Why did Dan remain on the ship? Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlet. Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. So Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali seem to be praised mostly for their courage in fighting, and these other tribes, especially on the east of Jordan that didn't get involved, are scolded, more or less, for not getting involved in helping out. Verse 19, the kings came and fought. Then the kings of Canaan fought in Taanak by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens. The stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Gishon swept them away. That ancient torrent, the torrent of Gishon, O my soul, march on in strength. Then the horse's hoofs pounded, the galloping of his steed. Then curse Meroz, apparently a location near the battle that didn't get involved. It's not known where Meroz was. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord, curse its inhabitants bitterly, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Most blessed among women is Jael, which is also something said about Mary in the New Testament. A statement in the New Testament that the Catholics think make Mary almost a divine person. Well, Jael must be too, because the same thing is said about her. Most blessed among women is Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. Blessed is she among the women in tents. He asked for water, she gave him milk. She brought out cream in a lordly bowl. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera, she pierced his head, she split and struck through his temple. Lovely. Beautiful poetry. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. The mother of Sisera looked through the window and cried out through the lattice, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots?" Her wisest ladies answered her. Yes, she herself answered. She could answer her own question. Why is he not home from the battle? Well, he's just having a good time with the spoils of victory. Are they not finding and dividing the spoil? To every man a girl or two? For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments, plunder of garments, embroidered and dyed, 2 pieces of dyed embroidered for the neck of each looter. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So the land had rest 40 years. Now this reference to Sisera's mother is an interesting touch. I mean, she's not even a character in this, and yet in celebrating the death of Sisera, they're almost gloating over the fact that his mother is worried about her son who's out at battle, and when he doesn't come back, she thinks the most optimistic thought. Well, he's celebrating victory. They're partying. They've got a couple women for each guy, and they're plundering the goods. Something that the mother of Sisera comforts herself with the thought of. Of course, what she's comforting her thoughts with is that her son's being a jerk, killing people and taking people's stuff. I mean, she's not a good woman, but she's got a mother's concern. And Israel, this song is sung by a woman, a mother in Israel too, and no doubt she can't help but think how a mother would think about this. You know, Sisera has a mother too, but she's going to have some bad news when she hears how things went. Well, that caused 40 years of peace to follow, and we'll have to stop there.